But let's start with something much more pleasing. Last year, my favourite Australian film was Strange Colours, the debut feature by Elena Lodkina about a young woman and her difficult reunion with her prospective father, which was set in an isolated community in Lightning Ridge. It was a film of such promise. I was so struck by Lodkina's sense of mise-en-scène. The way that she moved characters in the frame and moved the frame around them felt lyrical and classical. It was a director, clearly, who'd seen a lot of films, good films. Well, this year, I'm happy to share with you another great Australian debut feature, but one with a completely different style. Acute Misfortune is a film that relies much more on montage, the juxtaposition of images. It feels more like a film of fragments, shards that are placed carefully in sequence by editor Luca Capelli. And what beautiful images, striking visual ideas, often with high contrast lighting and an eye for how a single visual can conjure an atmosphere or a mood in an instant. Two cinematographers are listed in the film's credits, Stefan Duccio and Jermaine McMicking. So in a moment, I'll be asking director Thomas M. Wright exactly how that collaboration worked. Acute Misfortune is a story about an enigmatic man, the late painter Adam Cullen, and the young journalist who tries to write a book about him. That young man was Eric Jensen, who would go on to be the editor of the Saturday paper, something of a wunderkind, I guess you could call him, in Australian publishing. This film is based on his book about the relationship, Acute Misfortune, and transposed for the screen by Jensen himself with Wright. Now, Cullen lived amidst the expanse of wilderness and cluster of villages in the Blue Mountains, which are just an hour or so's drive west of Sydney. A bit like the setting of the film I spoke about on the show last week, Jafar Panahi's Three Faces. This is a place with one road in, one road out, the Great Western Highway, and one train line too that rises up from the Sydney Suburban Rail Network and weaves its way through tunnels and cliffsides into this high country with its mist-filled valleys and golden sandstone ridges. It is here that Cullen worked and lived an erratic, somewhat fantastical life, inspired by rugged outdoorsmanship and an eclectic group of friends who could spin a wild story or two. He's like a macho beatnik throwback, a character from a sinister bourbon commercial, living a life of heavy drinking, taking drugs, which are scored back down the hill in Sydney's western suburbs, firing guns off into the night and burning bonfires. All the while, the young journalist, played by a muted, evocative Toby Wallace, is becoming more perplexed by what he sees, because Cullen is both irascible and deliberately misleading. Is this a bold genius, a great man wrestling a bushman's pioneer spirit onto the canvas, or a coward running from his limitations? Not many films, not many Australian films, interrogate the myths around artists. Acute Misfortune does it well. And what about Jensen? Well, we'll discuss what we think the film is saying about Eric Jensen in a moment with the film's director. But meanwhile, I'd like to mention Daniel Henshaw's performance as Cullen, a shaven-headed, nuggety and slightly sagging man. He has what I describe as a Norman Mailer body. We first got to know Daniel Henshaw, of course, playing a psychopath killer in Snowtown. And here he plays Cullen with menace and aggression and frequent bursts of twinkle-eyed charm. This is a strong film about a strained relationship between two men of different ages, performed wonderfully well by both leads. These two men are of completely different sensibilities. They want completely different things from each other. The film is about the tension between subject and biographer. It's a coming-of-age tale, too, that plays as a kind of nightmare, as Eric Jensen is sucked into the orbit of Cullen's madness and the claustrophobic Blue Mountains wilderness. Coming up, director Thomas M. Wright, but first a clip, and there is strong language in this clip.
What did that say?
Everything in my life ends up in work. People try to elevate themselves and transcend, but there's absolutely nowhere to go. It's better if we just go down, because you don't know shit until you live it. Until then, it's just a fucking idea.
Well, Thomas M. Wright, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, tell me about this evocative quicksilver flow of images, this remarkable style. I mean, this is a film that if someone gave you the log line, you'd think, well, it's not going to be necessarily thrilling, but it is quite thrilling to watch because formally it's thrilling, I think. How did it all come together?
Well, I'll just say quickly just about the aesthetics and the way the story is told. The traditional way to tell this story would be very much grainy 16mm, you know, pressing close to these people, grinding guitars, and this kind of overwhelming and oppressive sense of masculinity. And that's really what we didn't want from this film. What we wanted was a feeling that was harder to put your finger on. The questions that were at the center of this film demanded a greater lightness of touch and a greater sense of contrast. So that's emphasized in all ways through the making of the film, through the kind of pastel tonality of the photography, and through some of those, you know, more complex cutting patterns, as you discussed.
Those pastels on the sandstone especially, is that what you're referring to there?
I'm just talking about, well, partly it's a reference to Adam's colour palette. I mean, I think one of the questions that comes up when you make a film about a visual artist, because they give you a huge vocabulary to refer to, was do you owe a debt to their aesthetic? And it was really a strong choice for me that we didn't owe a debt to his aesthetic, but we did to try to interrogate the ideas behind it and to try to get at the feeling behind it and get our own way of expressing that. Otherwise, I think you're just cheapening the art and potentially cheapening the film on the way too.
We'll talk about some themes in a moment, but I'm just interested about your relationship with Luca Capelli, first of all, who also, I mean, I mentioned how much I love Strange Colors, which came out a year before this film is coming out. And I know you're a great fan of that film too. And so you share collaborators.
Yeah, and interestingly, Elena and I both were outside eyes on one another's films during the edit. So we both came in and watched the cuts at kind of significant points in the development of the film. What Luca brings, Luca's a very unique editor. Luca actually comes from an art history background. And Luca, you have to be an extraordinarily capable technician to cut a film, but that's not Luca's strength. What Luca brings is not aesthetic or kind of, you know, responsiveness. He brings process, and he brings, like both Elena and I think, a willingness to kind of submit yourself to the ideas that you're trying to get at in the film, and at some point really let the film lead you. And where I felt like this film really started to work was where we stopped trying to control it and it started telling us what it needed. And it does have a very bold visual language. That was not a self-conscious thing. I don't think I was trying to do anything unusual with the film. I was trying to make a determinedly really strong narrative film because I feel like a lot of Australian films shy away from narrative and they tend to not put the most important events on screen. You begin after the guy gets out of jail. Well, why did he go to jail? I wanted to see, you know, really strong narrative storytelling. But I come from a background in theatre. I come from a background in devised theatre and experimental theatre. And I founded a company when I was 22. And by the time I was 23, 24, we were making work for all the major companies and major festivals around Australia. And so I come from a background of images, and where your choices about form and content are really reduced. It's like, are you going to have a proscenium? Is the show going to be a proscenium? Is it going to be on a thrust? Are you going to separate the audience? Are you going to take them into a space they've never been before? And that led me to try to use film like that, to really manipulate the form, which is why we ended up with shooting in the Academy ratio, shooting in a much squarer ratio than most films these days.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So the film's shot in 1:37:1, 1:37 across to 1 vertically. So it's a much squarer image. The thing that's interesting for me about that in a story like this is a story about portraiture. This is a story about people. It's about looking very deeply into people and not making easy assessments of people. So you have to scrutinize them and look at them very closely, and there's nothing else to look at in that framing. When you're framed on someone's face, there's no landscape. Their face becomes a landscape. It also lends itself to framing centrally and to sort of one-point perspective, which to me had to do with the finality, the inevitability that hangs over this film.
Well, yes, because it's a doomed relationship, isn't it? And that's where also the motif that you use wonderfully well and so evocatively of the trains, that one single train line winding its way up through the mountains comes in.
And again, you know, we're often shot through the front window of the train or the rear window of the train. So you get this sense of, again, it's that idea of kind of inevitability. The film does exist in a certain tunnel. There's an old Orson Welles quote that a happy ending just depends on where you stop the story. But there was only one place that we could really stop this story because of Adam's tragic end at the age of 46.
Yeah.
And Adam could be a very violent person. He could be a very, very difficult person, but he reserved his greatest violence for himself. And the film was really engaging with that idea of why? Why does someone do this to themselves? And he was, you know, the most celebrated painter of his generation, certainly the most publicly discussed. But he did live this really, obviously, it's, you know, aberrant kind of lifestyle toward the end.
I'm talking to Thomas M. Wright, who is the director and co-writer of the new Australian film, the best Australian film of the year so far, and certainly one of my favourites from last year. I was lucky enough to see it at the Melbourne International Film Festival, I think it was last year. It is called Acute Misfortune. It is out next week. It is a film about the relationship between Eric Jensen and the artist Adam Cullen, a kind of a figurative expressionist, I guess, might be a good way to describe him. Tell me about this arrogance, this abrasiveness, this macho persona that Cullen had. I start to get the impression that his own persona became the work of art he was most interested in, to the detriment of his actual canvases towards the end of his life. I mean, that's the impression from the film, I think.
It's very, very difficult to speak definitively about that. I would say the best statement I can make about that is probably in the film, because I think it's a very nuanced conversation. In the end, this is very much a film about a relationship, and it's very much about the kind of constructions that we bring into relationships. And it's a film about culture. It's a film about the cultural space that was made for Adam, the space that he claimed for himself, and the behaviour that was allowed from him.
What did all that represent, though, to you in your mind? I mean, it's in some ways is a very recognisable sort of very, as I said, very abrasive and sort of thrusting male, you know, masculinity really that, you know, he's the man's man, he's the outdoorsman. He's almost though something of an anachronism as well, I think. What's he inspired by, do you think?
Well, the film's about cultural change. I think Adam's receiving his images. Well, look, probably the best way I can answer that is to say that in terms of what I tried to do to address that as a question as a filmmaker was to have a dialogue with this history of Australian cinema. Adam idolised anti-heroes. He idolised Australian anti-heroes. He was Chopper Reid's best man at his wedding. And that kind of character, he surrounded himself with these kind of larger-than-life rogues gallery type people like Roger Rogerson or Charles Water Street. These were the people that Adam associated with. That's how he built his persona. And so we tried to reflect on that. How does this person receive this idea about how they want to be as a potent kind of person? Because Adam was, when you break it down, he was obsessed with control, I think. I think he wanted to control things, and the reasons that he wanted to do that were very complex. You could say insecurity, you can look back to his childhood, and that's why the film is kind of told as a literary detective story. You have this young man coming into this relationship with a whole different set of cultural references as a person of his generation and trying to look through these threads, look through this person's
work out. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Use it as a kind of key to draw closer to who this person is and what the reasons might be.
Well, I want to actually bring our discussion now to Eric Jensen. I mean, you wrote this screenplay with Eric Jensen. Now, you've obviously got distance from this story, and Eric Jensen is writing a story about himself, a screenplay about himself, essentially things that happened to him. At a certain point, it strikes me that this is both a critique of the great man sort of myth, but it's also very much a sort of coming of age story of Eric Jensen. This is Eric Jensen's crucible almost, how he, you know, learns not to get to know your heroes, and the crucible in which he's formed as a kind of journalist and publisher. But how difficult was it to collaborate on a screenplay with him? I mean, did you disagree violently over certain approaches?
We would disagree every day. And Eric comes from journalism. And so there are two things in discussion, two central poles of kind of professions. There's the art world and the world of journalism. And journalism is an extraordinarily combative environment. You know, whoever wins the argument goes to print, ultimately. But as a writer on a film, you can't work that way. It's also a much lengthier process. We spent 3 years working on this film. And of course, Eric had already written the book on which the film is based. But I said to Eric very early on in the writing process, if this film just exists to repeat the conclusions of the book, then there's absolutely no reason to make it. What the film has to set out to do is to question the book, to take another perspective on this, to step outside of this relationship.
So did you have to question Jensen a bit? Did you find?
Of course. I said to Eric at the very beginning, even before we started writing, I said, you're going to have to be willing to be a villain in this and to question your own motives. And the provocation from me to him was to say, we have to consider that this book could also be an act of revenge. I don't think that that's what it is in actuality, but I think in order to really appreciate that relationship, a relationship where Adam shot Eric in the leg with a shotgun, where he lied to him endlessly for years, including a lie about the fact that there was even a publisher attached to the book in the first instance. He threw him off a motorbike. This is a relationship that then Eric takes over. After Adam passed away, Eric returned to the book, wrote it and completed it. And now when you look up Adam Cullen, Eric's book is there as the kind of marker of who this person is. And what I was interested in talking about both journalism and the culture of literature there is on the dust cover of the book, there's a little piece there that says, this is a book told at close quarters and without judgment. And I just thought, that's ludicrous. There is,
it is indeed ludicrous.
How can you write something like this without judgment after going through that?
And so your aim was to, I think you've made a film that, as I said, is thrilling to watch and sit through. It's evocative and very artful, and you walk away from it, I think, with a lot of questions, but very informed questions after having watched the film about this relationship. I do want to, just in the seconds we have left, I do want to ask you about this, the two cinematographers who are credited on this film. What happened? Did someone have a fist fight in the middle of the film and just storm off?
Not at all.
I'm joking.
We knew that Jermaine McMicking, who I originally contracted to shoot the film, was going to have to leave to shoot True Detective Season 3 in the States. And so we talked about how best to structure this. And again, with that form and content question, we thought there was something really interesting about actually committing to the relationship but then bringing another cinematographer in at a certain point.
Because it's very subtle. I mean, the film doesn't really, it doesn't signpost any kind of difference. And I should allay people's fears. If they have any, it doesn't, come across as a bad thing at all.
Not at all. But I think what we could do within the arc of the story, because the story is really about drawing closer to the idea of who Adam is and drawing closer to the idea of who Eric is. We begin with all sorts of facades and all sorts of complex dynamics. By the end, it's a very bare film, a very Spartan film. And so Jermaine is very painterly with how he shoots. That lent itself beautifully to the front end of the film. And then Stefan tends to work with less light sources, more high contrast. And you're left with a kind of a beautiful, barer image toward the end. So it was a brilliant gift to the film, actually.
Absolutely. Look, the result is on screen for all to see from next week. Fantastic. It's on limited release, but in every state in Australia, I think, every capital city except for Adelaide, unfortunately. I don't know why
that's exactly right. Fingers crossed. Well, we'll wait and see. But actually, there was a special screening on tonight at the Sun Cinema in Yarraville. That's unfortunately sold out. But there are special screenings next week all through Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Brisbane, all around the rest of the country.
Well, get along to see it. The film is Acute Misfortune in cinemas from next week. It is the best Australian film of the year so far, maybe the best Australian film of the year. It is one of the best Australian debut features of recent times. Thanks, Thomas, for coming on and talking to me about it.
Thanks so much.
That's director Thomas M. Wright of Acute Misfortune. You're listening to The Screen Show on RN.